Thank you, Femi. The outbreak of swine flu causing concern from Mexico to New Zealand certainly isn't the first epidemic in history to spur widespread worry, and certainly not of flu. As you know, in the past, at least we had good news to go along with the panic. In November 1918, the city of San Francisco was worried about the influenza pandemic sweeping the globe, but that wasn't going to stop the party about the end of World War I.
The war is over. Into Market Street for the men and women of the city to celebrate. Up and down the street they parade, delirious with joy. For some of them have come to know the meaning of war. Grotesque and ugly in their influenza masks, the people of San Francisco celebrate.
It was a part of life in San Francisco and elsewhere around the world in November of 1918. World War I was over, but the influenza was still there. Joining us to talk about the sort of history and fear and mythology of epidemics like this and moments like these is Phil Alcabas, professor of urban public health at Hunter College of the City of New York and author of the forthcoming Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to Avian Flu. He's in the studio with us. Thank you, Professor.
Nice to be here.
So there is a lot psychologically that drives populations at moments like this when the numbers are small, but the history is so disturbing.
It's impossible not to be afraid where we've got fear built into us.
Rightly so.
And naturally so. What I'm pleased about with it, with respect to at least the last few days of dealing with this new problem, is that the response on the part of authorities has been pretty uniformly measured. And in fact, we've heard from New York City's health commissioner, from federal officials, don't panic.
And, you know, don't panic is a good suggestion, but it's also, you know, it takes a while to know what's going on here. I mean, in 3 days, things can rise exponentially. You don't want to panic, but you do want to take steps, and already people are putting on masks. Is that appropriate?
Well, information's good, and we don't have all the information we need yet. And I know you were just talking to a Times reporter who's been trying to get information, as all of the news outlets have been. And it's just impossible to get all the information because this is too new. Masks, well, as your clip from San Francisco in 1918 mentioned, masks probably don't hurt, and there's a little bit of evidence that they may have helped in the past.
And certainly we're seeing pictures of people in Mexico wearing masks, and, you know, I guess if it makes you feel good, do it. But if it causes other people to panic, maybe government should, you know, weigh in and suggest a better course. Let's talk about the flu itself. Every year, a lot of people die of flu, right?
Yes. Flu produces an epidemic. We call it seasonal flu. In this part of the world, it's every winter, comes around in November, and it's usually gone by this time of year. The situation in Mexico is a little bit late compared to usual.
Now, it's my understanding that more people than 103 die of flu every year in its normal seasonal occurrence. How many?
Those numbers are, first of all, they vary from year to year, and it's hard to gauge because it's not always clear when people die from influenza itself or when they die from complications.
Complications, I see.
But there are thousands of deaths
thousands,
the U.S. every year.
Thousands, just in the U.S.
Right,
every year.
Right.
Is flu the most concerning disease because of the death toll of 1918 or because it's so infectious and moves so quickly?
It's a great question. Essentially, you're asking about psychology versus epidemiology.
Right.
Why things concern us is a complicated question. It has to do with the fears we bring to asking about epidemics, the anxieties we have about our own behavior, about our own society. Flu is certainly worrisome because of its capacity, two things, its capacity to change its coat, to change its—
To mutate, right.
Yes, exactly, to mutate. And also because it can move between species relatively fluidly. But is that why it's the greatest concern? I think your question is right, that part of what concerns us is the devastation of 1918. And one reason why I wish we would throw the term pandemic around a lot less is it tends to remind people of 1918 and think that each time there's an unexpected flu outbreak, anything other than the seasonal flu which we've become accustomed to, that tens of millions of people are going to die.
Now, certain biological terrors have been sort of arrested because of vaccines. Polio, I think, is one notable example.
Smallpox.
Smallpox, another notable example. But others have been eradicated simply by changing our relationship to the environment. Cholera, which is a huge global problem in the industrialized world, really doesn't exist.
Right.
And it basically involved changing the way we deal with water. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that in our kind of on the way to 9 billion population in the world that our interaction with the biological environment has shifted, and so suddenly flu and these kinds of viruses create an opportunity that if we were to change our relationship with the environment, they would just go away?
It's impossible to predict what would happen if we changed our relationship to the environment, but you're absolutely right. Diseases, epidemic diseases come and go, sometimes because we do something about them, but much more often because humans change the way that change our own social organizations. We decide to live in cities. We change the way those cities look and are administered, or we change the way we eat and the way we produce food. And I think that has a lot to do with what we see with flu, and potentially gives us an angle on how to change the flu situation.
Hmm. You know, I'm looking at the numbers here, and in a world where there are 6 or 7 billion, I mean, it sounds like a movie ad, in a world where, you know, is it even possible to close borders, to take preventive steps, to you know, circle the wagons and prevent something from happening once it reaches a certain level?
It's probably not possible to make borders impermeable. I'm not sure that that's the answer. I mean, or potentially, that's a short-term answer. We saw some of that with SARS in 2003, and you see some suggestion of that here with this current flu situation, inspecting travelers, cautioning people who have come back from Mexico who have a temperature above 100 or so to go to get tested. But that's not, in the long run, that's not going to be the answer. The answer is going to have to be something that goes much more to the principle you just articulated. We have to think about the way we humans interact with the environment, with animals, the international commerce in animals, food, feed, et cetera.
So responsible vigilance, but don't panic. Good advice from Philip Elkavitz, professor of urban public health at Hunter College of the University of New York, and author of the forthcoming Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to Avian Flu. Professor, a well-timed book title to be forthcoming at this point, but thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Swine flu has got the world on edge. There are still a lot more we don't know about, and we're going to continuously update you throughout the morning. We'll have experts and reporters on, and we want to know, what questions do you have? Let's get involved in that responsible vigilance that Professor Elkavitz was talking about. We'll try to answer your questions throughout the day. 778-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And on that, here's your takeaway.
Hong Kong is the best prepared of all because this place is terrified and has been terrified for 6 years of having any repeat of SARS. In fact, during SARS, we stopped shaking hands here.
Yearning to be in Hong Kong. That's Keith Bradshaw, the New York Times Hong Kong bureau chief, talking about preparedness in Asia. If you missed any part of our show, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.